Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. Today, we have a very special guest. We have Joe Burnett. Joe Burnett works at Unchained, and he also has a pretty awesome YouTube channel, which I'm a pretty big fan of, and he's dropping some really, really good content over there. You could go follow it, youtube.com/@JoeBurnett27. I think he does like a couple minute videos every single day, and they're really, really awesome. So big fan of his content. Also, when he was part of Blockware, that was really, really cool. So I'm excited to have him on the show today. But before we jump into it, I do want to give a shout out to the Bitcoin company that powers this show, makes Simply Bitcoin IRL possible. And of course, I'm talking about Bitcoin Well. Bitcoin Well is the best place to build your automatic self-custody Bitcoin stack, self-custody by default, future-proof your money, enable independence via bitcoinwell.com/simply. It's the first on Bitcoin on-ramp in the United States that is self-custody by default. What does that mean? That means that if you buy Bitcoin on Bitcoin Well, you have to take self-custody, which perfectly aligns with the Simply Bitcoin ethos of the separation of money and state. After all, self-custody is the revolution. All right, no more delay. I do want to bring up Joe on stage. Let's bring up Joe. Thank you so much for joining us today on Simply Bitcoin IRL. I was fanboying a little bit. You've been dropping some really high quality content, man, on your own personal YouTube channel. You've been covering some specific subjects. Some have popped off, some go a little bit sideways. I know how content creation goes. So how you doing, man?
Good. Thanks for having me on the show and appreciate it. I mean, I try to make videos that help people understand Bitcoin and spread Bitcoin adoption. So happy to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So how long have you been making content?
That's a good question. I mean, I started my Twitter account like probably back in like 2018, 2019. And I think that's how I kind of like started creating content, like started to like be a voice and somewhat of a voice in the space. I just started writing Twitter threads during the whole bear market. And then especially at the bottom of the 2018, 2019 bear market, because I had discovered Bitcoin in 2017 and, you know, just going through the whole bear market, I was like, price keeps going down, but I still feel like there's something here. Like, I still feel like we're right about Bitcoin, and just kept writing threads. And that's about when it all started, and never really stopped writing various things and making videos now about Bitcoin.
Nice, nice. So I do want to kind of address the elephant in the room, which is breaking news. The DOJ has formally indicted and arrested the founding members of Samurai Wallet. And this is pretty crazy. I think it's kind of like an escalation on the war on privacy, something that we've been covering for over a year now on Simply Bitcoin when they first indicted the Tornado Cash developer. In my belief, that kind of set a precedent towards kind of the demonization of privacy. And now they've really escalated. A lot of people weren't paying attention to Tornado Cash because it kind of related to an altcoin. But we were making the case on Simply Bitcoin that, hey, look, this is the first time in U.S. history where the Treasury Department is literally sanctioning an open source software. And fast forward a year later, here we are. You know, this is a major attack on Bitcoin, in my personal opinion, definitely a major attack on privacy. It's my fundamental belief that if you can't have freedom without privacy, and I think that this is where we are in the movie, 1 to 2 to 3 years down the road, inevitably they're going to go after self-custody. That's the next step. So if we don't hold the line here and we don't make our voices heard, I think things could get a little bit precarious here, specifically in the United States. What are your thoughts, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking back to like some of the founding fathers of America, you know, had pseudonyms writing, you know, for freedom and liberty. And so, yeah, I think, you know, Bitcoin is freedom money. And, you know, it should be free. I don't think like if, you know, America really does start to crack down on privacy or, you know, Bitcoin self-custody in any serious way, I don't think that's like a long-term threat to Bitcoin. I think it's a long-term threat probably to like the future of America. It'd be like America, you know, banning the internet, like North Korea or something like that. So I don't think that that's the right path to go down. I haven't read too much about this specific indictment. I've been in calls all day, but it's not, from what I've heard, it doesn't seem great. And I think, you know, Bitcoiners should be pro freedom and pro privacy, and I think that's, you know, good for Bitcoin if, you know, more people can easily be free and easily be private.
Yeah, and I agree. I think it's almost, you can make the case that it's like a necessity also. But there's been so many regulatory attacks, you know, the last 6 to 9 months with this current administration, right? The so-called Operation Choke Point 2.0, the Wall Street Journal article that was used by Elizabeth Warren and co. to put pressure on the FinCEN and the Treasury to introduce more kind of like hostile Bitcoin regulations, circumventing the legislative process using the Patriot Act. And of course, Elizabeth Warren's infamous bill that's currently in the Senate that has 20 senators, including two Republicans, I might add, that would be, to use Pierre Richard's own words, not mine, a de facto ban on the Bitcoin mining industry in the United States. Not to mention the fact of Joe Biden's proposed 30% mining tax or tax on Bitcoin miners, right? Trying to kill the industry. So clearly there's elements of the U.S. government that are hostile towards this technology. Those aren't my words. Cynthia Lummis at the Bitcoin Policy Institute Summit, she literally said, she's like, look, there's elements of the U.S. government, there's politicians that, you know, want this thing to go away because they can't control it, right? So, yeah, I mean, I think we definitely have this uphill battle in terms of the regulatory environment. And one of the things that I've come to know about Bitcoin, or maybe this realization that I had really, is that this is really about power fundamentally, right? I think the federal government gets a tremendous amount of power from being able to issue its own money. And I think Bitcoin is a fundamental threat to that, giving people the ability to opt out of that system entirely, that political system. So, I mean, I get what you're saying, but from my angle, and perhaps it's because, you know, Simply Bitcoin, we're slaves to the news cycle and we have to cover every single little thing that's happening and we see it. I think it's inevitable. There is going to be a clash. I see it. I see them coming up with these bureaucratic terms like unhosted wallet and stuff like that to kind of demonize self-custody. And look at all the centralization of the custody of these of the Bitcoin ETFs, right? They're all held in Coinbase, making it extremely easy for a 6102. So, yeah, I mean, you guys must think of that, of course, at Unchained. You guys provide an incredible collaborative custody product, which I'm a huge fan of. You guys must think about that a lot, right? The regulatory environment and the hostility here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, anything that I say is not going to be, you know, representation of Unchained. I'm just on the Unchained marketing team. But yeah, I mean, we have our enterprise custody product where you can have, you know, billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin, and one, you know, custodian or one key agent would not be a single point of failure for that enterprise's Bitcoin. So you can have, you know, a key agent in the UK, you can have a key agent in Texas, you can have a key agent in New York City or Georgia. So yeah, I mean, I think if there is risk where people are beginning to be worried about, you know, their custody solutions, like we saw this when FTX collapsed, right? When FTX went down, everyone had the realization that if you are trusting your Bitcoin with one single third party, then there's a lot of risk to that. And you want to make sure that you're, you know, mitigating that risk and potentially eliminating it, or at least eliminating any one single point of failure with that risk. So yeah, I mean, I think Unchained's key product is building a Bitcoin financial services company that they are not a single point of failure for, right? So like the Unchained Personal Vault or Unchained Business Vault is all about a 2 or 3 multi-sig where you as an individual hold 2 keys, Unchained holds 1 key. And so Unchained cannot move your Bitcoin. If an entity contacts Unchained and says, hey, can you move your client's Bitcoin? Unchained still cannot do that. So it's all about eliminating any single point of failure with your Bitcoin. And at the end of the day, you know, with Unchained Personal Vaults, you still hold 2 out of 3 keys and you have complete control over your Bitcoin.
No, and like I said, I'm a huge product, right? So Unchained holds 1 key and of course the individual holds the other 2 keys, right? So even if something were to happen on a regulatory aspect, right, the individual still has, you know, complete access to their Bitcoin wallet as long as they still have access to those two keys, right? Yeah. So yeah, it's a, like I said, big fan of the offering. I've personally used it in the past myself. Can't recommend it enough. But I kind of want to change the subject a little bit here and just focus on some of your recent writing, some of the recent topics that you've talked about, right? So you recently wrote a report, Your Wealth is Melting. Could you go into detail about that, or just elaborate a little bit? Maybe not into detail because I don't know if we'll have enough time, but touch on some points.
For sure. Yeah, so the reason I wrote it, I can start with that and then kind of go a little bit in depth and then we can stop. But the reason I wrote it is I think a lot of people think about Bitcoin as a lottery ticket. Like if you are not deep into Bitcoin right now, you are like, this Bitcoin thing is like Tesla or Nvidia or another crypto. And it's just, you know, hyper volatile. It's could go up a lot. It could go to zero. It could go down a lot. And I don't think that that's the right way to look at Bitcoin, obviously. I think the way to look at Bitcoin is that it's money. And so how do you actually use money? Well, you use it to, you know, evaluate and perform economic calculations with your wealth or with your traditional assets. And when you actually look at, you know, the assets that you're investing in your traditional 401k or, you know, your traditional financial advisor, it's typically, you know, a diversified portfolio of S&P 500, you know, treasury bonds, you know, real estate, could be gold, a little bit of gold. And all of these assets have one of two problems or both of these problems. They can either be perpetually produced, meaning we can always mine more gold, we can always build more real estate, or they can be devalued, right? Like you have Nvidia where they are potentially, you know, creating GPUs for $500 and then they're selling them for $30,000 and they're highly, you know, on a margin basis, they're, you know, potentially highly profitable and they're growing really fast. So the value of Nvidia is, you know, $1 trillion, $2 trillion today. But when Nvidia is worth $2 trillion, meaning humanity is storing $2 trillion worth of wealth in Nvidia, that just means that there's going to be a lot more competitors trying to figure out how to make a better GPU or make a better computer chip. And whether that's for a cheaper cost or selling it for a cheaper price or making, you know, slightly, you know, more expensive GPU, but it's significantly better. So like all of these assets that we're holding today as a civilization, you know, the market is like trying to fight against it. And like the tide is going away and it's debasing the value of those assets. Whereas Bitcoin is just this one unique tool where it's a monetary tool. So that means like economic systems can converge on one tool. That means they can't really be debased by creating another Bitcoin, but it's a perfectly scarce monetary tool, meaning like we can't create more Bitcoin. So I think it's like very unique in that it's the only perfectly scarce monetary tool in the world. And a lot of what people are doing today is trying to like create this like makeshift, beautiful, diversified portfolio just to, you know, get a market rate return. And I think this diversified portfolio that everyone's searching for is really just Bitcoin. And once you look at that, once you look at it like that, you realize all of these traditional assets that you're holding are actually, you know, especially at today's valuations, they're really melting away because we can always create more gold. We can always, you know, build more houses, build more apartment complexes. We're always going to have competitors to you know, companies like Nvidia. So storing your wealth in these assets for, you know, decades is probably not the best strategy. Maybe, you know, holding Bitcoin for decades is the best strategy.
Yeah, and I completely agreed. And it almost, in a little bit, in my experience, it almost kind of confuses someone, let's say a high net worth individual who is used to, you know, and I love this, diversifying, right? So, you know, they put some money in real estate, they put some money in index funds, right? Maybe they have some stocks that they're a fan of, right? Maybe they have some money in gold. And this is what their wealth manager, I'm not trying to bash, I'm friends with a lot of wealth managers and people that work in the traditional financial system, so I'm not trying to bash anyone individually, but this is like the traditional advice that you'd be given. And this kind of realization that I've come to, Joe, is that Bitcoin is so simple it's sophisticated and complicated, right? Like you're pitching, it's like, so you're telling me I only have to buy this? And I'm like, yeah. And then they're like, so wait, I don't have to pay fees. I don't have to deal with the wealth. I don't have to, you know, do these like sophisticated. And I'm like, yeah. And then that kind of opens their mind after they pay their price of tuition and they go through this denial phase and blah, 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 blah. And then they start listening to the kid in the hoodie rather than the guy in the tie. But, you know, it's kind of like a culture shock in a way. Like it's really like it hits hard, especially if you've been used to dealing in the traditional financial system. And I see this the most with ultra high net worth individuals and high net worth individuals who they have to do this in order to maintain their wealth. But like you said, your wealth is melting if you're kind of using these things. And you tell them like, look, it's just Bitcoin. Just buy Bitcoin, earn Bitcoin, mine Bitcoin, put that Bitcoin into self-custody. That's all you got to do. Watch it go up. And they're so used to doing all these little different things that, you know, it's almost perplexing to them. So that's been my experience. I don't know if you've had a similar experience yourself.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Like, I think Bitcoin sounds like how I brought it up, I think, at the beginning. Like, people think Bitcoin is a lottery ticket that could go to $1 million. I think they're right about that. It's a lottery ticket with pretty good odds that will probably go to $1 million eventually on a long enough time horizon. But yeah, no, I think a lot of people, you know, without Bitcoin, it makes sense to have this diversified portfolio. It makes sense to have a little bit of real estate. It makes sense to have some S&P 500. It makes sense to have, you know, some cash, some government bonds or whatnot, some corporate bonds. But now that Bitcoin exists, you have to evaluate your opportunity cost against holding all of those traditional assets. And then once you realize that Bitcoin is just actually like perfect money, and, you know, 94% of all Bitcoin have already been mined, and global adoption of Bitcoin is probably less than 1%, arguably, then we're going to see like 99.9% of the world try to, you know, adopt Bitcoin, because literally we're mining more gold every year. We're building more houses every year. We're if you store your wealth in NVIDIA, then there's going to be startups that go and compete with NVIDIA. And so you got to figure out how to get exposure to those startups. And so like your wealth in these traditional assets is actually melting in Bitcoin terms. And like, it's not just me saying that it's happening. It's been happening for the last 15 years. You just have to look at those assets priced in Bitcoin. But instead, everyone's distracted. They're focusing on their assets priced in dollars. And they're like, oh, wow, my house that I bought for $500,000 is now worth $600,000 over the last, you know, 24 months. It's like your house didn't actually go up in value. It's like the dollar went down in value. And it's like if people realize that they're just using the wrong money, like they're using the wrong unit of account, and they realize that like, hey, there's a better form of money to like actually measure my wealth and actually measure my economic returns, then maybe your house, you know, that you bought for 30 Bitcoin is worth 7 Bitcoin right now. And maybe you should be a little bit more concerned that, hey, I have a lot of wealth in, you know, this house or a portfolio of houses or a portfolio of stocks. And, you know, they're actually falling in Bitcoin terms, which is unprincipled money. It's like, if you're going to measure your wealth, and you're going to, why would you measure it in a monetary good that a certain group can print more of? You want to measure your wealth in money that no one can print more of. That's probably going to give you like the best, you know, realistic estimate of how you're performing financially and how you're, if your wealth's actually going up or if it's going down. And Bitcoin is that best money.
100%. And then you kind of buried the lead there, and I want to double back and focus on it, which is this idea that like, yeah, and you hear this a lot, right? The American dream is dead, right? Like, you can't afford housing. Like, specifically, it seems like you're in my generation, right? Millennial generation. You know, it's this idea of like, wow, like, we can't afford things. We're screwed. We're effed. Like, goddamn. But you're absolutely, you hit the nail on the head. If you've been earning and saving in Bitcoin, the American dream is thriving. Not only is it thriving, it's been exported all around the world. Housing has actually gotten progressively cheaper over time, right? So 100% agree with you. So one of the things that I've come across, you know, being a Bitcoin content creator, is this idea of, dude, are we in an effing echo chamber, brother? Like we make content for other Bitcoiners. When the price pumps, you know, you get this new influx of other people that are listening to your content. But still, it's you know, it's like we're still in this echo chamber. We're slowly starting to break into the mainstream consciousness. You have, you know, this is shout out to Natalie for doing this, but you have anchors on Fox Business saying stuff like the Fed only benefits the very wealthy. You have that MMA fighter that just got recently like beat up. He won the fight. Joe Rogan puts a mic in his face and he's like, Austrian School of Economics for your country to thrive. So like we're definitely making progress, but we're not quite there. What has been your experience kind of breaking the Bitcoin echo chamber? Sadly, like from my, and maybe it's like a, this Greek tragedy. I don't know what you want to call it, but from my experience, it's the only thing that works is number go up. Like number go up is like what gets people to care. That's when your parents-in-law give you a call. That's when your parents give you a call and they're like, hey, I like this Bitcoin thing. Can I buy more? But it's never when, you know, we're at the bottom. At the bottom, they're calling you, seeing if you're okay. But it tends to be like when the price of Bitcoin starts to run that, you know, the echo chamber breaks and the reach of Bitcoin only content, you know, we get bigger reach. We start to get exposed to a newer type of audience. That's been my experience. What's been your experience so far?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think thinking about the echo chamber idea, I think it is funny. Like I think I tweeted the other day that the whole reason that I made my Twitter account, I think back in like 2018, was because I thought this Bitcoin thing was so interesting. I had read through like Pierre Richard's work, all the Nakamoto Institute, and I was like, this is just like some random blog on the internet, but it just seems so logical. And I would like try to find out like where they're wrong. And I just like couldn't find a good reason. And then, you know, you'd watch like Bloomberg or CNBC or whatnot, and you'd have these talking heads, you know, still do today to some extent, but they would be talking about Bitcoin, how it's like tulip bubble or Ponzi and stuff like this. And I'm like, there's probably like my research at the time was like, all right, there's better arguments against Bitcoin, but these arguments, like, it's like if Jamie Dimon's talking about Bitcoin, you can tell he's, you know, read like spent like 24 hours max looking at Bitcoin. Like he never really spent time to actually look into it. So it's like, if the people that are managing trillions of dollars worth of capital haven't like even taken the any time to actually think about Bitcoin from a, like a first principles perspective and get out of their echo chamber, because it's really they're the ones in the echo chamber. Like I was in the echo chamber. Like when I first heard about Bitcoin, I was like, oh, this thing is certainly a bubble, worthless. It's just a, you know, digital rock. Who would actually want to do this? But then I was like, wait a second, like this is just money. Like the Bitcoin is actually just the world's best money. And like, that's why it's, you know, has a compound annual growth rate of like 130% over the last 13 years. Like the world is literally just adopting a new form of money, and it's been happening and it's probably going to keep happening. And there's no reason like the trend that would ever reverse. So yeah, I mean, I think there is an echo chamber, like somewhat on Bitcoin Twitter for sure, but like there's a bigger echo chamber in fiat world and like traditional finance for sure. What stops the echo chamber is, I certainly agree, like number go up. Like over time, Bitcoin goes through cycles, you know, supply gets tight, the holders, you know, people that are like us that are in Bitcoin just keep holding our Bitcoin, the price slowly starts to drift up, it makes new all-time highs, and then people like the number go up, you know, people buy more, early Bitcoiners even buy more, new Bitcoin, like people that are new to Bitcoin start buying more. And then the price just goes on a crazy run. And then it attracts so much news, so much attention. You know, you heard Jamie Dimon or whoever in the last cycle or two cycles ago say that Bitcoin was a bubble, but then, you know, Bitcoin is now 500% higher. It's like, you know, or 6x higher or 10x higher. It's like, how is Bitcoin a bubble? Like this guy was very wrong. I should have bought a lot of Bitcoin back then. And so I think that the more touch points people get, they're like, okay, like this Bitcoin thing might actually be real. And then it makes them question it. And now we have, you know, ETF approvals, like BlackRock is embracing Bitcoin. And, you know, maybe that's not the best way to hold Bitcoin, but I see the BlackRock ETF is like a top of funnel Bitcoin product. You buy some of that, you get the number go up. And then later you're like, okay, I actually need to do some form of self-custody or collaborative custody, like Unchained. So yeah, I mean, I think number go up kind of eventually solves it. And I think it's just going to be a repeating cycle for, you know, time and time again.
100% number go up. It just solves the doubt, except for Peter Schiff. I don't know what happened. Like something broke his operating system. I get it. I understand him, but you know, at the same time, it's like, dude, Bitcoin's a humility test, and he can't eat his humble pie. So anyways, I do want to pivot the conversation a little bit and talk about, let's start going through all these. We touched upon them a little bit, but I want to start with Bitcoin versus real estate. One of the major problems that I think people of our generation are having is that a lot of the housing has a premium on it because people are, and I believe Unchained, by the way, wrote a great article about this. And perhaps it was Parker. I don't know. My memory's playing tricks on me, but I'm pretty sure it was hosted on Unchained, and I think the name of the article is like the Great Definancialization or something like that. Yeah. So real estate clearly has this premium. I live in Miami, bro, and the housing prices when they started the pandemic stimulus, it's like 230%, like nuts, like, you know, houses that were, you know, like $600,000-$700,000, like apartments better said, that are worth like $600,000-$700,000, 2019, 2020, you know, 2-3 years later, they're 1.2, 1.5, right? Clearly, if you know, if you're an asset owner, which tends to be the upper classes, the older generation, you're like, that's cool. They're not really getting richer. The value of those properties aren't really going higher. But you know, if you are specifically in the younger generations, the you know, the millennials, the Gen Zers, the younger, the lower and middle classes who don't have the means to save in assets, that are saving in fiat, they're getting rocked, right? They're looking at this and like, how can I ever afford a home? And you know, this is one of those things that Bitcoin fixes, I think, from two perspectives. Perspective number one is, if you've been living on a Bitcoin standard, even when houses doubled, you're still significantly cheaper for you. That's number one. And number two, I think over time, I think this is going to take a much longer to play out. It kind of takes away the monetary premium from a lot of the, you know, a lot of housing. So I wanted to ask you about that. Like, why does housing have this monetary premium? How does Bitcoin fix this? And how long do you see this situation playing out? How long is it going to take?
Yeah, definitely great questions. And, you know, it's interesting to talk about. I mean, everyone hoards houses today because the money is broken, right? I think housing is actually like, you know, you'll hear like private equity is kind of like become a big term, I feel like, over the last few decades, where the whole strategy of private equity is like borrow a bunch of money at some of the cheapest interest rates in the world, buy a business, hope the business keeps growing, and there, or, you know, try to operate it in a great way. And you can sell the business for 2x in 1 year, but because you borrowed so much money from the bank and put so little equity into the business, the equity, you know, when the business went up 2x, your return was like 10x or massive because you used a lot of debt to get access to leverage. Real estate is how like relatively normal people can kind of do the same thing, where it's like you borrow, you know, you pretty much are going 5x long US real estate when you access a, you know, a typical 30-year mortgage by putting 20% down and you borrow the 80%. And so you're going, you know, 5x long US real estate. And that's actually been a pretty profitable trade, especially in dollar terms, over the last, you know, 50 years, probably more. And it probably will continue being a very profitable trade in dollar terms. But now that we have Bitcoin, which is, you know, actually better money, you can measure your this new opportunity cost and say like, well, I could have, you know, bought this house for $500,000. It went up to $600,000 and I made $100,000 off of that. Maybe with leverage, I made a really good percentage return, not just 20%, but maybe I made 100% return off of that in dollar terms. But the house actually may have been bought for 30 Bitcoin and now it's worth 7 Bitcoin. So you're better off just actually buying Bitcoin instead of hoarding all of these houses. And so I think that that's going to be one way is like real estate investors, people that hold these apartment complexes or, you know, millions of single family homes in the US, but also all over the world, they can literally get a better return and on a long time horizon, in my opinion, a safer return by just buying and holding Bitcoin. Like the house has no property tax. The house doesn't have regular maintenance. You don't have to, you know, improve the house every decade. You don't have to get in, you know, a new AC machine. You don't have to get a new water heater or whatnot. You don't have to do all of these things. You can literally just buy and hold Bitcoin, and you're most likely going to outperform these, you know, single family houses that you're just hoarding. And so you win by getting a better return. The wealthy win by getting a better return, and normal people will win by actually, you know, getting access to real estate. If marginally more people that are hoarding this real estate and renting it out to people just decide to market sell it and let, you know, families, young families that are, have been renting forever or can't afford a house today, maybe the market selling from all of these investors would be enough to drive down the price and make housing a lot more affordable for many people. Timing wise, I mean, it's definitely a big question. And in my Bitcoin predictions, I feel like I'm definitely hyper bullish a lot more than many other people, but I also like don't ever really specify like exactly when I think Bitcoin is going to hit, you know, hit $1 million or when one Bitcoin equals one average US house. But I think like within the, you know, within 10 years, like, you know, you'll be pretty happy with holding Bitcoin versus holding a, you know, a massive portfolio of single family homes in the US. So I think the trend will be pretty obvious in hindsight. You know, it might take very long time to play out. Maybe like boomers continue holding, you know, their homes for decades, but that just means cheaper Bitcoin for people that actually understand what's happening and that Bitcoin is a better money and you'll probably outperform them. Maybe housing won't get immediately cheaper for you, but you'll in Bitcoin, you'll get a better outperformance and maybe the houses will slowly be falling in Bitcoin terms and enable you to actually, you know, buy a house for your family.
Yeah, and I agree. And Bitcoin gives that opportunity to millennials and the kind of the younger generation. And you buried the lead. So I'm definitely going to put you on the spot. You said you don't like making predictions. So, but you're hyper bullish. So what's the price of Bitcoin going to be in 2030?
Good question. I would say by 2030, it's you know, like people bring up the models and like the models have been like a funny topic of conversation with the debate between like the stock to flow model based on the halvings and then the power law model that Giovanni likes talking about now and he created. And then you have like the Saylor version of all the models are broken, NGU, it's going up forever. I would say like, there is, you know, nothing would really surprise me to the upside, right? Like we live in a fairly fragile world. Dollars are a fairly fragile system. Bitcoin is an anti-fragile system where like if you attack it and you try to hurt it in the short term, it might, you know, go down or bad things might happen. But I think in the long term, it makes it, you know, stronger and better. And so by 2030, I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not, you know, $1 million per Bitcoin seems pretty likely. Like I think like power law model, and I'm not like endorsing like these specific models, like they're just, you know, lines on a chart. So they're patterns. They're not like mathematical law by any means. But I think like the power law model is probably like my base case for Bitcoin, which I believe is like, you know, $1 million Bitcoin by around 2030, 2032. And then like stock to flow would probably be like $10 million per Bitcoin in 2030, 2032. And that seems a little aggressive. It wouldn't surprise me. But it's certainly possible. But yeah, I'd say like probably $1 million by 2030 seems somewhat reasonable.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And I just want to put this ticker just as a disclaimer for everyone that Joe Burnett 1000% endorses the power law model. No, I'm just messing with you. Okay, so $1 million by 2030. That's it's kind of like the general consensus, right? Did you see? I'm sure you saw the Cathie Wood. The Cathie Wood kind of prediction where she put the bear case 245, the base case 648, and then the bull case is like 1.5. I believe she even moved the 1.5 up recently. Then why do you think it's so hard to kind of like conceptualize that? And before you answer that question, Joe, I would say, you know, are we late to Bitcoin or do you know the diminishing returns start to play in? like, you know, now that fees, the halving, it was crazy. It was, man, it was so nuts. I was at the Bitcoin Magazine halving live stream, and we were just looking at the fees, and it was like $237 to get a transaction in. Is Bitcoin a currency of the wealthy elite now? It's part of this community that's like, no, this is for the plebs and whatever. But if it costs $237 per transaction, you know, if the best gains are already, you know, past us, you know, are you a believer in the diminishing returns? Has the train already left? Are we too late? What would you say to that?
I think like again, I'd say my base case for Bitcoin is power law model, which is in fact diminishing returns. I think that that's, you know, maybe that happens. I tend to think no, like I'm like I said before, nothing would surprise me to the upside. Like I think Bitcoin is like, if you're pricing everything in Bitcoin, which I think eventually everyone will, then we have, you know, massive amounts of wealth is being created just from technology, AI, robotics. And that's like only accelerating, right? Like you have the Jeff Booth price of tomorrow, you know, hyper deflation thesis, which I completely agree with. And so like, we're going into a period where we're becoming extremely productive on an exponential basis, like, and it's getting faster and faster. And we're trying to fit all this wealth into all of these different assets, like real estate, whatever. And it's not really fitting into these assets because we can always create more of them. So I think a lot of this wealth eventually just ends up in Bitcoin at the same time that consumer prices should be like exponentially collapsing due to, you know, AI, robotics, whatnot. So like, if you're measuring Bitcoin in like how much food you can buy or like how much, you know, basic housing that you can buy, I think it's going to be like hyper, there's probably not going to be diminishing returns with that because it's like two functions like going in the opposite direction where like things are becoming increasingly more abundant and wealth is increasingly, you know, going exponential. And not only that, but Bitcoin is becoming exponentially more, you know, a larger share of total global wealth because it's outcompeting all these other asset classes. So there's a really good case to be made for, you know, non-diminishing returns. However, you know, if, you know, base case is still probably like a power law model where like, you know, Bitcoin still outcompetes everything, which means you should have a massive portfolio allocation to Bitcoin. But, you know, maybe it just takes a little bit longer than we expect. And on your second point of, is Bitcoin a monetary tool only for the wealthy elite because of, you know, limited block space and high transaction fees? I would disagree with that. I mean, I think like this runes and ordinal stuff is probably a short-term fad. And it's like, we've already seen, like, I think the mempool hasn't cleared in like 1 year, or it's been roughly a year since it last cleared, but there's been periods where like transactions were clearing for six sats for a virtual byte, which like, if you're just using the single sig wallet, that's probably less than a dollar to make a transaction. So, I mean, base layer Bitcoin is for long-term savings. So like, I wouldn't put $5 on the base layer, but if you have $1,000, you know, or maybe even a little less or more, then like, that's what you should be using the base layer Bitcoin for, whether it's single sig, whether it's multi-sig. And like, there's going to be other layers that develop on top of Bitcoin. I think high transaction fees actually incentivize the development of other layers. So to some extent, you could even argue that like these high fees that we've been seeing, while they aren't good in the short term, because they don't really, you know, intuitively promote self-custody, especially for people that may not have a lot of wealth, they are good in the sense that it's going to encourage, you know, funding for things like Lightning or Fedimint or other scaling solutions that we can't even comprehend today. So I think, you know, long-term, Bitcoin is not just a monetary tool for the wealthy elite. And I think we're still, like I said, so early to Bitcoin, where like less than 1% of the world really understands Bitcoin and has truly adopted Bitcoin, in my opinion. And, you know, 94% of all Bitcoin have already been mined. So like a small allocation to Bitcoin, or like, you know, $1,000 in Bitcoin today could be worth, you know, significantly more 10, 20, 30 years from now, that like, you know, the price is going to go up so much that you actually got a pretty big allocation from your small initial buy that you made.
100%. I agree with that. I think a lot of people feel that, right? Is that, you know, it's infinity divided by 21 million. It's going up forever, Laura. right? So it's probably a good idea to have some just in case it catches on for sure. And I think Wall Street is waking up to that. I think, you know, high net worth people are starting to wake up to that reality. And what I've noticed over the years is that 1% allocation turns to a 2% allocation, turns to a 3% allocation as they get addicted to NGU technology. So you were mentioning the power law earlier and how, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'd say that you are somewhat of a fan. Is that safe to say?
I admire the model. I mean, okay. Like, yeah.
So you admire the model. What is the power law model for anyone who is just not in the know? What is the power law model? What does it predict? How does it work? You know, what is the, you know, what is it exactly?
Yeah, so I will do not a great job of explaining it. Giovanni, the guy that created it, can explain it fairly well, I would say. But in cities or in animals or like in the universe, there tends to be like this trend called a power law. And it's like if you model specific, you know, data points on this like X and Y, you know, graph, you can clearly see there's these consistent trends within nature, within the human body, within all these different like very unique things. And Bitcoin just happens to be following this exact same pattern over time. And, you know, it's pretty interesting. Like it will eventually break, in my opinion, because like the dollar will break, Bitcoin will like break to the upside, or Bitcoin will actually break. And for some reason, you know, it doesn't end well. I don't see that happening, but anything is possible. But Bitcoin is basically tracking this thing called the power law, and it's like it deviates above it and it comes back to the power law, or deviates below it, it comes back to the power law. And it is on a diminishing returns scale. Like the x-axis, which is time, is on a log scale. So like over time, the, you know, distance between each like epoch for 4 years gets closer and closer, and the returns over each epoch gets smaller and smaller. But it's been following that trend for, you know, the last 15 years. So maybe it will continue to follow it. Maybe it won't. I think like my big thing is like no one really knows how to price Bitcoin, right? So and it makes sense because Bitcoin is just money. So like once we get past, you know, hyper Bitcoinization, Bitcoin will just be money and we'll price every other asset in Bitcoin. Like we'll create like a DCF of a company and figure out what the price of the company will be based off its future cash flows that are in Bitcoin terms. But like right now we don't know how to price it because like we're kind of pricing Bitcoin adoption, and like Bitcoin adoption is just from humans like collectively trying to figure out, you know, what this even is. And it's like if you're early, then you should, you know, have a massive allocation. If you're late, you'll eventually get an allocation, but you don't have one yet. So it's like we're trying to model the rate of adoption, which is like the rate of human action, which is like incredibly difficult. And so like, yes, maybe there's like this pattern that has repeated in nature that's now within Bitcoin itself and or within the Bitcoin price history and may continue to be in the, you know, Bitcoin's price future. But it could certainly break. And like, you know, it's hard to predict Bitcoin adoption, right? Like if we have a phase shift where, you know, people lose faith in the dollar or other fiat currencies rapidly, and there's a massive shift to a new form of money, which would probably be Bitcoin, then that would be, you know, probably break the model pretty massively. So yeah, I mean, I think it's just like it's basically just like a model that has occurred in nature and in physics and other, you know, parts of the universe, and Bitcoin just happens to be following it so far, and maybe it will break, but so far it has remained intact.
Yeah. And it's interesting, right? I forget who said this specifically, but it was like, all models work until they don't, or something like that. I'm totally butchering it, but something along the lines. And I think that's an accurate, observation on models specifically now. Okay. So again, pivoting the conversation a little bit. So it's very interesting because we're kind of in uncharted territory in the sense that Bitcoin made all-time highs before the halving, right? I think we peaked at like 74K. Is the cycle theory dead? You know, I hear that so much from so many people. I don't believe it is. I think Bitcoin is just chugging along like it always does. So I wanted to get your take on that. Is the cycle It's a cycle theory dead.
I think Bitcoin cycles will probably always exist, especially like before hyper Bitcoinization, before like the whole world has adopted Bitcoin as money. Because it's been happening for the last 15 years. I expect it to continue happening. The question, I guess, is like what actually drives the cycles? Like some people say, you know, the halvings and the supply distribution drive the cycles. Some people say it's the, you know, macro liquidity that drives the cycles. It's just like, is the Fed, you know, have the money printer on? Is the federal government running massive trillion-dollar deficits? Is that, you know, stimulating, you know, growth and asset prices? I think it's probably a little bit of both, personally. But I think that there probably will be, you know, cycles that will continue to occur. And it's kind of what we talked about earlier, where it's like people come into Bitcoin, not necessarily because they initially understand it's better money objectively because of its unique monetary properties, but they figure out Bitcoin because it's just the number is going up, right? Like they're like, okay, the number is going up. I thought it was dead. Buy a little bit of Bitcoin today. And then, you know, when the number is going up, if that's when people are buying, well, the number is going to go up a little bit too much in such a short period of time. And it creates like these exponential parabolic, you know, bull runs that are just like completely unsustainable. Like I was talking to Dr. Jeff Ross recently about it, and he was like, it makes sense because like whenever you see these exponential functions within, you know, like the human body, whether that's cancer or viruses, like those don't end well. Those are not sustainable. It's taking up too much resources. Something bad is going to happen. And that's kind of what happens during each Bitcoin bull run. Like you have these like crazy fast exponential explosions in the price. And a lot of people that are buying into Bitcoin at the time are buying in only because of number go up, and they don't have the, you know, understanding that Bitcoin is the better money. So when the volatility does come, because Bitcoin is growing so fast and it's, you know, eventually going to come, then they get shaken out of it. They're like, wait a second, I'm not exactly sure what I bought. You know, Bitcoin just fell 10% in one day. It's down 30% off the all-time high that, you know, it recently made 1 month ago. Yes, it still happens to be up, you know, 100% from a year ago, but this downward volatility in the short term is freaking me out. So I'm going to, you know, potentially sell some of my Bitcoin or stop buying Bitcoin. And then we create that, you know, inevitable bear market where it's like the price starts going down, more miners, you know, a bunch of miners came online during the last bull run. And, you know, now they're selling all this Bitcoin to cover their operating expenses. Maybe they got into business when they shouldn't have. And maybe now they're like dumping their Bitcoin treasury, trying to just survive as a business. You know, the core Bitcoin holders are still holding their coins. They're not selling, but the price is set on the margin. So like the marginal seller meets the marginal buyer, and that price could be moving down pretty fast. So yeah, I definitely think the cycles will continue. And I think it's important to be prepared for them, like as a Bitcoin holder. Like you want to make sure you have a strong balance sheet. You want to make sure you have solid income, and you want to be, you know, consistently stacking and staying humble. Like the last thing you want to do is ride to the top of the bull market, think it's never going to end, and then take out a massive, you know, leverage long on Bitcoin for whatever reason, because you think it's going to keep going up because you're overly greedy, and, you know, you'll just get wiped out. So I think it's just critical that, you know, you should recognize that Bitcoin adoption is occurring. It's going to probably going to continue occurring, and the volatility is going to come at some point, and you just got to be prepared for that.
Yeah, 100%. And yeah, I mean, I have a good friend of mine. So Odell's famous quote, right, was stay humble, stack sats. But a good friend of mine who actually made a bet with Adam Back in regards to Bitcoin hitting 100K before the halving. His name is Vikingo, and I added to Odell's line, it's not only stay humble, stack sats, but it's stay humble, stack sats, stay solvent. And I think that's a really, really important kind of aspect into it, because I think a lot of people, perhaps they kind of put themselves in a levered play. Perhaps they don't have sufficient cash flow or income coming in, where they have to put themselves in an uncomfortable situation where they have to sell some of their Bitcoin just to pay for living expenses. So yeah, that's a very, very important point. I think Bitcoiners have to be aware of that. So let me ask you this, and I'm aware you're going to be incredibly biased, obviously, but what is the best, like, long-term, in your eyes, what is the best way to store Bitcoin long-term? Best way to store Bitcoin long-term?
You know, like a lot of people now are talking about the ETFs. They're excited that they can buy Bitcoin in their brokerage account, log in, type in FBTC or whatever ticker they want, and it's easy and you click buy. And I think that's a cool way to get started with Bitcoin. But I don't think that that's the end game. And I think once you get some of that number go up, you're going to recognize that there's actually a better, safer way to hold the Bitcoin, where like you are free to move the Bitcoin. You're not relying on any single trusted third party to make sure you have access to your Bitcoin. And so in my opinion, collaborative custody, potentially via Unchained, which is where I work for, obviously, is one of the best ways to hold your Bitcoin. I was an Unchained client before I joined Unchained to work there. And I think it's cool is every other exchange that you're using to buy and sell Bitcoin, whether that's FTX, Coinbase, you know, Kraken, whoever, if their website goes down or they, you know, lose their keys forever, reason or whatever happens, you lose your Bitcoin. Like you don't even really have Bitcoin. They had your Bitcoin. You just needed to request it to get it off. Whereas Unchained, if Unchained goes out of business or disappears tomorrow for whatever reason, you still have your Bitcoin. Unchained's just there as a backup to make sure that you don't lose your Bitcoin, right? You can have a 2 out of 3 Bitcoin multisig where you hold 2 keys, which means with both keys, you have complete control over your Bitcoin. And then the 1 key that Unchained has, which means they can't move your Bitcoin with just that 1 key. They're just there as a backup in case, you know, one of your keys happens to get lost or stolen or whatever reason you don't have one of the keys anymore. You can work with Unchained to actually get access to your Bitcoin and move it to another vault. So it like eliminates any single point of failure with your Bitcoin. And anyone that knows has worked with Bitcoin self-custody, it is kind of scary at first, right? Because you're like, wait, did I, you know, type this address in correctly? Like, what if I wrote down my, you know, 24-word seed phrase wrong? Or what if I recorded it incorrectly? And maybe I haven't done the recovery process in a while. I hope it's still there, right? Like, you want to make sure that your self-custody setup, you know, you can't just make one mistake and lose your Bitcoin. So that's kind of what Unchained does. We help you. If you do happen to make a mistake, which does happen to some people, then you don't lose all your Bitcoin and you just move it to another vault and you know, you have access to your Bitcoin. So I think it's pretty much the best way to safely hold Bitcoin for the long term.
Yeah, no, the collaborative custody is I definitely agree and definitely something that I would recommend to people that don't have the technical know-how to kind of set it up themselves. It provides a kind of like that backup key, like you said. And that's definitely something that I would recommend to high net worth or someone that has a decent enough bag in Bitcoin and they're older and they need and you guys, I believe that you guys offer like this like platinum version of it as well, that kind of has like a concierge, like a phone number to call just in case you run into technical, which you will run into technical difficulties with multisig. That's inevitable. So you guys do offer that like white glove service, I believe, as well, right?
Yep. Yeah, we have concierge onboarding, which is like if you are a complete beginner, like you are, you know, an 80-year-old grandma or grandpa or 90 years old, and you're like, I want to try this Bitcoin self-custody thing. Like, you can get on a call with a Bitcoin custody expert, Bitcoin hardware wallet expert, and they will literally like walk you through the steps. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's awesome. Very, very cool. All right. So we are getting to the top of the hour, about 3 minutes left. So Joe, I'm going to hand you the mic figuratively or metaphorically. I don't know what the right term is for that. I'm going to give you the stage. And if you had, you know, any closing thoughts for the audience, anything that's top of mind, anything that, you know, is near and dear to your heart, that you want to tell the, you know, the 720 people watching live right now, what would it be?
Yeah. I mean, first, thanks for having me on. Really enjoyed it. I feel like I'm usually the guy asking questions on these types of things. So it's kind of interesting to be on the other side of the mic, I guess. But, yeah, no, we brought up our report earlier, or my report that I wrote called Your Wealth is Melting. If you want to check that out, you can go to unchained.com/melting. download a free copy. You can also follow me on Twitter, you know, III Capital, 3 Capital. And yeah, I mean, closing thoughts overall, like Bitcoin is going to be volatile, but it is objectively the best money in the world. It has, it's immutably absolute scarce, portable, durable, divisible, fungible, etc. And I think the world is actively converging on Bitcoin as the best money. I don't think that that trend is slowing. In fact, I think it's accelerating now with Bitcoin ETFs and more and more people actually endorsing, you know, Bitcoin itself, and the number going up, right? So we're seeing the number go up. We're seeing more people get into Bitcoin, but just continue to be prepared for, you know, unexpected volatility. You know, get your coins off exchanges, you know, set up an unchained vault to make sure you don't lose access to your coins, and, you know, keep saving Bitcoin and just, you know, keep living your life and providing value for other people. I think that's one of the beautiful things about Bitcoin is like, you now don't have to, you know, invest in real estate. You don't have to buy the next Tesla stock. You can just live your life, provide value to others, and hold Bitcoin.
Awesome. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Joe Burnett, you go check him out on his Twitter, which told you guys about. And of course, go follow his YouTube channel. He's dropping some amazing content. You can search, what's it called? Joe Burnett, right, on YouTube. Is that correct?
Yep. It's like Joe Burnett 27 or something like that.
Joe Burnett 27. Very, very good high signal content. And Joe, thank you so much for joining us on Simply Bitcoin IRL.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
Appreciate it. All right, guys, that was our show. We'll be back for the live show tomorrow to discuss Samurai. What's going on with that? I mean, look, it should not have caught any of you guys by surprise if you guys have been tuning into Simply Bitcoin. So we're going to do a deep dive on that. I'm going to go full Nico Jones because this is something that I feel very passionate about. Did you think that they were just going to give over the keys gently and just go gently into that good night? No, this is the separation of money and state and on. So buckle up, take self-custody, and spread the peaceful Bitcoin revolution. The way that we do that is we get more individuals taking self-custody, more individuals waking up to the reality that it's not left versus right. It's not red versus blue. It's green versus orange. Anyways, I'm Nico. I'll see you guys tomorrow for a brand new episode of Simply Bitcoin Live.
Episode was brought to you by BitcoinWell.com on a mission to enable independence.